Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM.
Hello, good evening and welcome to the Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM with John Dixon and myself, Ben Emmett. Firstly, good evening, John.
Good evening, Ben. Hi, everybody.
Hi, everyone. Indeed, as ever, you can contact us by email. Our email address is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie, or you can text or WhatsApp us on 087-179-1032. That's 087-179-1032. And we're also available live on the internet at dublincityfm.ie and as a podcast. And we're going to start, as usual, with what to see in the night sky as the nights are closing in and closing in.
Yeah, certainly, they certainly are. Mercury's not mentioned on my sheet this week, evidently out of sight. We won't see that one. Venus, that's the one that you saw. When was it? This morning? Yesterday morning? 4 o'clock
yesterday
in the morning?
Yesterday morning I had reason to get up at just after 4 a.m.
Yeah.
And not that you have to get up that early to see it, but yes, you can't mistake it in the east, southeast, like a searchlight.
Yep. You look east just before dawn and during dawn. And Venus rises more than 2 hours just before dawn's first light, so you get to see that. That's why you saw it at 4 a.m. in the morning. You weren't raiding the fridge like I do. So it looks like a weird UFO in the eastern horizon. So in a telescope, Venus is a very thick crescent, almost half-lit phase, dichotomy. There's the proper word for you. -4.6 on the magnitude. Very, very bright. And a very fine sight to see. Mars, unfortunately, is out of sight as well, behind the glare of the sun. Jupiter, -2.8. Still a good thing to see in Aries rises in the east, northeast, and late twilight. And Jupiter dominates the eastern sky later in the evening and shines highest in the south during the early hours of the morning. And it's on its way to opposition on November 2nd, which is not that far away now at this stage. Saturn, on the other hand, +0.6, you can still see it. In fact, we saw it the other night, Ben, when it was pretty close to the moon. And it's just like we'll call it an orangey type of a dot, but it's very well recognizable as well. And it's in the southeast in twilight, shines it at a good height as well for telescopic viewing as early as 8 p.m. And now it's at its highest in the south around 10 p.m. Uranus and Neptune, two elusive planets, very hard to see, 5.6 for Uranus and magnitude 7.8 for Neptune as well. So Uranus is just 9 degrees east of Jupiter, if you can manage to find Jupiter. And Neptune is on the Aquarius-Pisces border and nice and high mid-evening, 25 degrees east of Saturn. That's about 3.5 fist width at arm's length. Yeah, there you go. So just to give you an idea of where that is as well. So poor old Mercury, unfortunately, out of sight this particular week anyway. So it'll come back soon to see us, but not right now.
Thank you, John, for that. So essentially, you can't miss Venus in the morning sky or indeed Jupiter in the evening skies. Of course, we also have the sun and the moon too. The moon is not currently above our horizon here in Dublin at the moment. It will rise tomorrow morning at 3:40 a.m. It will be a 12% waning crescent moon as we head towards the new moon next Saturday. And as I say, it will rise at 3:40 a.m. and be due south of us, passing the meridian at 11 a.m. tomorrow morning, when you'll see slightly less of it. And then when it sets tomorrow evening at 6:03, it will be down to an 8% phase. But the sun will still be up then, of course, and it'll be difficult enough to see. As we head towards, as I mentioned, a full moon on Saturday the 14th at 6:55 p.m., which this Saturday coincides with a annular solar eclipse. Perhaps we get to that in a moment. And I just mentioned sunrise tomorrow in Dublin is at 7:43 a.m., which is 12 minutes later than a week ago, and local noon is at 11 minutes past 1. The sun will set at 6:38 p.m., which is 17 minutes earlier than a week ago, and from then until 7:13 we'll have civil twilight, and from then until 7:53 we'll have nautical twilight, and from 7:53 to 8:34 we'll have astronomical twilight, and after 8:34 p.m. tomorrow we have astronomical night. That means we've 29 minutes less daylight tomorrow than we had a week ago. When tomorrow there'll be another 4 minutes and 8 seconds less daylight than today. And there will be 10 hours and 55 minutes between sunrise and sunset.
Wow. Yeah, we don't have to tell you that it's getting darker sooner. Yeah, I don't know whether you saw a couple of Draconid meteor shower things out the other morning. They've been around, they peaked on the 8th and 9th, which is yesterday, and the day before. So if you saw a few little shooty starry type things, they have in the past produced hundreds per hour, but there are no expected, or hasn't been any expected showers of that, so you get an odd one here and there. They can appear anywhere in the sky. There are a few still knocking around for the next week or so, and they can appear anywhere in the sky, but they should point back to the constellation Draco, so if you put that into Google World, and it's best seen in the evening hours. Well, that's a good idea as well. Now, something else to look forward, the Orionids, 21st of October. This is another average show producing 20 to 30 meters per hour. Now, I'm not sure where the moon, I think, sets around 10:30 on the 21st, thereabouts. And this one is produced by Comet Halley, or Halley's Comet, as we all best well know it as. Best viewing will be from dark locations after midnight. And if you don't see them up to that, you just have to hang around for a little while. And Orionid meteor showers can appear anywhere in the sky, but they also point back to Orion and Orion's belt, which is easily recognizable in the sky as well. The partial lunar eclipse, October the 28th. And this is where the lower edge of the moon will clip the Earth's shadow around 9:15. And how many weeks we got to go?
Four, yes. It's the next full moon. I think I may have given you a rum steer there.
No, that's next, it doesn't matter.
Next. Yeah, next Saturday there's a new moon.
Yeah.
But then when we can come around to the full moon, we'll have the new moon on Saturday concurs, is that the word, with a annular solar eclipse, which we'll just about see a little bit of it here. I think there'll be a bit of, or will we be outside? No, I'm confusing about the 2 weeks later when we get to the full, when we'll have a total lunar eclipse, and we will, we will see some of that. So a lot of the moon will be in the penumbra shadow of the Earth, but I think some of the bottom left corner will be a bit darker again. So when we get to the new moon, essentially, it won't be the usual bright full moon that we would normally be used to, because some of it will be in shadow, in part of the Earth's shadow.
Yeah, it's not very big for us, unfortunately. Only a tiny little nick as it sweeps in and sweeps out again. So October the 28th for that partial lunar eclipse, if you're a lunar eclipse watcher like somebody across the street from me here.
Well, we like all eclipses. Yes, and 2 weeks before that, which is next Saturday, when we have the new moon, if you are in certain parts of the United States and Mexico, you'll see an annular solar eclipse. But it's none of it's visible here from Ireland. But 2 weeks later, when we get to the the new moon, we'll see some of that lunar eclipse.
Yeah, went into.
I'm confusing myself here. Yeah,
last week when you were off on your gallivantations, if you want to call them that, I went into a subject of what would be left on the moon at the moment. So as we know, Apollo 11 left flags, and Alan came back to us, said that the ultraviolet would have sort of made it very brittle. It was probably falling to pieces. So the question is, are the flags that are left on the moon still standing or flying or whatever they're doing or hanging or everything? But Alan told us last week that he thought that the ultraviolet light would have absolutely...
I think so, yeah, the radiation. Destroyed. And the forms of radiation would have made them, would have degraded them.
Yeah,
they should be still upright.
Yeah, the
because there's
themselves,
nothing to blow them down or blow them over.
No.
Unless they got hit by a big meteoroid, which is possible.
Well, that's possible.
Not likely.
Yeah, too many. Anyway, the other bits and pieces that were left behind were gold-plated ultraviolet telescope, the laser-ranging retroreflectors, which are still in use today, and they tell us exactly how far the moon is away from us. It's a remarkable feat of engineering just to have a little thing about maybe 2 foot square or 600 millimeters square reflecting, and we can point a laser at it, and it bounces back and tells us how quickly the moon is moving away from us. There are others, all sorts of other stuff left as well, so bits and pieces. Mm-hmm. So they have cameras, and every time they brought back a moon sample, they had to leave something behind because of the weight restrictions. So at some stage, I think,
sure, there's
imagine,
a golf ball up there.
There is,
Apollo astronauts is, playing a bit of golf.
Yeah, it's probably destroyed as well, with ultraviolet as well. But I wonder how long that drive was. I think he only used a 6-iron, that one, so it would have gone probably 5 miles.
Well, the gravitational forces are only, on the moon are only 1/6 that on the Earth, and of course there's no atmospheric drag as well, so should be able to get a good long record.
Yeah,
a record for a drive.
Whoops.
Now, a little nearer to Earth, but still beyond the Earth's atmosphere, the International Space Station, not visible from Irish skies at the moment, back in morning skies in a couple of weeks' time. But I see there has been detected another leak from a Russian segment of the International Space Station. And I think this was only discovered yesterday, but it's the third coolant leak in under a year, and it seems to be raising a few questions and a few worries. Apparently at no stage were any of the astronauts on board in any danger, because it was part of a coolant system that was on the outside, a backup coolant system on the outside, the external part of the International Space Station. But their main coolant system was on the inside, and that seemed to be working okay. This particular radiator circuit was delivered to the station in 2012, and it's on the part of the Russian segment, the Nauka, I hope I pronounced that correctly, Nauka, which means science in Russia, and also known as the Multipurpose Laboratory Module Upgrade, or LMM, which was launched back in 2021, and I think it was mission controllers in Houston discovered it or saw it through one of the cameras and asked the guys and gals to go up to the cupola and have a look, and sure enough, they saw some, what looked like some snowflakes. And this particular item, primary radiator, which I mentioned earlier, is working normally, so that's providing full cooling to the module and has no impact on the crew or the space station. But as I said, it's the third leak. Back in December, there was a leak from a Soyuz spacecraft, which they sent it back to Earth uncrewed and sent up another one uncrewed to dock with the International Space Station. And that meant that a couple of the astronauts up there had to spend a lot longer than they had originally planned. And way back in February, there was also a leak on the Russian Progress MS-21 cargo ship, which had been docked to the ISS since October 2022. So when you hear one leak, you think it might be a meteorite or something small, but when there's three of them, you think is there something, some people are raising questions if there's some systemic problem. I think somebody's trying to point a finger at some of the Russian subcontractors. Maybe so, but there's no definite proof of that. So
they're saying the succession of these leaks lowers the probability that they were caused by meteorites, where in the beginning, as you say, they thought it might have been a strike from a meteor or a micrometeorite, and it's questioning some of the reliability of the space systems that run that. But no doubt they'll get to the bottom of it. And so imagine looking out the cupola and seeing just snowflakes outside. Look, lads, it's snowing.
Snowing in space.
Yeah, snowing. Viewing point, that one as well. I'm sure when they have a little bit of time off, they go up in there just to have a little look around, because they're always sort of pointing towards Earth and they take photographs from the windows, and that must be some sight to look down and see what's going on our little planet here.
Must be a good one. All right. Yeah, that's one thing the place I'd stay all the time, I suppose. Because you see most of the rest of the inside of the International Space Station, it's just crammed with stuff. The four walls or the six walls above and below, and, you know, I don't know how many windows there are. I think there was one or two before they put in the cupola, but nothing much. But that's a great viewing spot. So you're listening to the Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM with John Dixon and myself, Ben Emmett. Our email address is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie, and the text and WhatsApp number is 087-179-1032. That's 087-179-1032, and you can catch us live on the internet at dublincityfm.ie and also as a podcast.
Yeah, now China's solar telescope array has been officially completed. Last Wednesday, in fact, it went through all its tests for this telescope array in southwest China, passing the key testing, marking the official completion of the world's largest synthesis aperture radio telescope, according to the Chinese Academy of Sciences. I'm going to get into this word. It's CAS for short. So when we hear that again, we know exactly what it means. So they said that the telescope array is a landmark equipment, a piece of equipment of the country's space environment, and they're going to look at all sorts of things as well. So it's an open area at an altitude of 3,820 metres in Daocheng County in the Sichuan province. So that's pretty high for a telescope. Now, it doesn't really, when you look at it, look like a telescope. It's just like a fence around an aerial in the middle with all sorts of clock segments or pizza segments in there as well. So it'll be interesting to see what that particular unit will send back. And it can sort of calculate a radius of a unit of distance in astronomy equal to the current radius of the sun, which is about 695,500 kilometers. So it's quite a large, it sees quite a wide distance into, well, we call it the skies, but into space. And it's going to be interesting to see what happens to that over the coming weeks and months and years to come as well. Heating and cooling in space habitats is not easing. Well, we could predict that as well. So China, India and the US have all achieved landings on the moon since 2020. And once there, their eventual goal is to set up a base, but a successful base, along with the spacecraft that will carry people to the little moon that we call it there. And it must be habitable for humans, and a big part of creating the habitable base is making sure that the heating and cooling systems work, because that's a serious problem, because it goes to minus 180 thereabouts in centigrade. And that's particularly true because the ambient temperature of potential places for a base can vary widely. And they go from -208 to 250 degrees Fahrenheit, which is -130 to 120 degrees Celsius. So there's a big swing in temperatures there. And it's not funny if you're stuck out in that, because you'd freeze pretty quickly. Similar, just to give you an idea of what Mars is like, it goes from minus 153 degrees centigrade to 20 degrees. So that's probably a little bit more human orientated, but it's going to take a little bit longer to get there. So they're working on this at the moment, how they're going to get heating and cooling onto the surface of the moon, into the little buildings that they're thinking of building. And are they going to be mounds? Are they going to be other types of things? Are they going to live in the lava tubes down there? Which is a big, big plus, I think, because they're already there. Just stick a door in the front and there you go. You have a house.
Thank you, John, for that. I see they're having a bit of... The Spanish are getting into the old space race now. They had a successful rocket launch now. It went up 29 miles or so above the Gulf of Cadiz. This is, it's actually the country's first private rocket launch, and that was on Saturday. It was at 19 minutes past one in the morning our time. And, it was launched from a military base in the southern region of Andalusia. And it was a great success. It was, even though it was only a mere 5 minutes flight, it landed in the Atlantic Ocean and they went off to retrieve it, of course. But they say it's the first rocket built 100% with Spanish technology, and therefore they're really pleased with themselves, and rightly so. And the launch of this 12-meter rocket was suspended. It was supposed to be launched originally back in May, but they had to suspend that planned launch because of strong winds, and then a second planned launch in June was also postponed because some of the umbilical cables which provide power and fuel to the rocket did not release on time. So they are basically now planning on building a bigger rocket to go further and eventually launch, well, you know, satellites into space, which is going to be a big, big market, it appears, the space industry in the next couple of years and decades ahead, and there's going to be, and there already is, a big market for launching satellites, especially small ones. And for small-ish satellites, you need relatively small rockets. You don't need an Ariane 5 or anything like that. So, and they can be produced pretty reasonably cheaply and quickly, I suppose. And the next launch will actually be from the French National Center for Space Studies in, well, that's actually the people who they collaborated with on this particular launch, but the next launch will be from the Space Center in French Guiana for their bigger rocket, not from the middle of Spain.
Yeah. Now, keeping on to satellite shoebox-sized space labs, were launched yesterday by Vega. I didn't hear that anything went wrong there, so I'm presuming that everything went A-OK. And they're little shoeboxy things. They're twin miniaturized laboratories, or CubeSats, as we know them as, and they're for the in-orbit demonstration of disruptive state-of-the-art space technologies as well. So certainly technology is a big thing that's... And what these are going to do, I'm absolutely not sure, but there's evidently a cunning plan, as we call it, for what they will do. So they're being flown through the European Commission in-orbit demonstration and in-orbit validation program. So we better Google that and see what exactly what that has to show us in the coming weeks.
Thank you, John. If you're into watching live space launches, there's one planned for Saturday. You can see it on NASA TV, and it is at the sociable hour of the launch is planned at just after 3 p.m., 3:16 p.m. Irish time, and it's the launch of the Psyche probe to it's a metal-rich asteroid in the asteroid belt. But if you like watching them live on TV, because being live, you don't know what's going to happen. They always make me a bit nervous.
It's strange. We've nothing to do with it, but we always feel nervous.
Yeah, really. And breathe a sigh of relief when they go successfully well. Yes, yeah, indeed.
Just talking about launching again, Amazon launched two satellites last Friday as part of its plan to deliver the internet from space and compete with Elon Musk's Starlink service. So they're all at it now. So everything went
off. Yeah, money to be made. Big business out there.
It certainly did. And once up and running, the company, founded, of course, by Jeff Bezos, says that Project Kuiper will provide fast, affordable broadband to unserved and underserved communities. And there are still a few of those around the planet, so that's a good sign for things to come.
And I've read, too, only recently of a prototype satellite called Blue Walker 3, which apparently is one of the brightest objects in the night sky. I don't know whether you can see it from our latitude here in Ireland, but it's apparently it outshines all but the brightest stars. And this goes back to a question that we that's been raised many times and we spoke about here on this program about the amount of these nanosatellites and not-so-nanosatellites scurrying across the sky.
Yeah, all the time. Yeah, scurrying is a good word.
Destroying, well, if you're doing, if you want to do any serious observation, when you're an amateur astronomer or a professional astronomer and there's something going past your field of vision constantly, it can be very disruptive and lead to kind of false results if you're not, if you're measuring, say, light inputs or things like that and you see these blips and you think, what the hell is that? And you have to go back, I suppose, maybe visually and check, see what's going on. They are a nuisance from that point of view, but of course they do provide services, as you say, to especially internet services to remote parts of the world.
Yep. Now, space parking, this is what's going on at the moment. Space needs better parking spots to stay usable, and any mission heading towards space needs a good parking spot at its destination. With these parking spots, regions located on orbits are quickly becoming occupied or more vulnerable to collisions. Now, this is a big worry for the amount of satellites and bits and pieces that are up there as well. So most objects launching to space are satellites, which can travel faster than 4 miles per second. How do you get your head around that one, I wonder? It's really, really quickly. And in the regions where they park, it's about 10 times the number of satellites currently in space, which are expected to launch by 2030. So that's more going up. And simultaneously, satellite constellations are increasing in number and size. So I think you'll have to buy a parking ticket, I think, in future to get your little parking spot in space, just to make sure. And that, as I say, the big worry is collisions in space with any satellites that are whizzing around or scurrying around is the word that I think you use there as well. And Astroscale Japan is to inspect a large defunct satellite in orbit. This is part of an experiment and it's been selected by the Japan Ministry of Education, Culture, Sports and Science and Technology for its small and business innovation research program to develop an on-orbit inspection demonstration mission that will image and diagnose a large defunct satellite in space. This will help them to promote research and development for Japanese startups and organize and engaging in advancing innovative technologies and to facilitate the smooth implement of results through government support. So they're using this as a bit of an experiment to, so that they can come up pretty close and inspect defunct satellites, whether they try to get them going again or just nudge them out of the way back to burn up into space, into the Earth's orbit, we just don't know. But this is technology at its best now. So Japan are doing this for us.
Thank you for that, John. And thanks to Alan for reminding me about the, you remember that? I'm sure you've seen that film, John, from taken from inside the lunar module of Apollo 17 as they take off and the flag that was a few meters away being blown over.
Mm-hmm. I do remember that.
Yeah. And probably the others were blown over as well. Although I thought that was sprang
Apollo,
back to one.
Apollo 11, although the flag was pretty close to the module itself, it only just flapped. It was quite close to it, and I couldn't figure out ever why they put it so close to the module. But evidently, with no wind and everything, it's just nothing to happen. Anyway, that's about it, unfortunately.
Thank you. And just before we go, Alan also points out that Heavens Above, which is where you can get the times for the International Space Station, has, will also, you'll be able to get the times too for that satellite I mentioned, Blue Walker 3. Thank you for that, John, and for your news items. But that's all the time we have this evening here on The Astronomy Show. You can write to us, astronomy@dublincityfm.ie is the email address. And that's all from me, Ben Evans, for this edition of The Astronomy Show on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Up next is Hello China, 9 o'clock, Brian Lynott with Threads, 11 p.m, Nigel Wood with Ear to the Globe, and from midnight to 2 a.m, we have Dave Barry, he's after hours with his mix of jazz, blues and soul. But please join myself and John at the same time next week. We'll be back with all the latest news from around the universe. Until then, take care of each other. Thank you for listening. Say goodnight, John.
Good night, John.
Good night, John. And all that is now, and all that is gone.
Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM.